Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WVUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The June 30th deadline for the pullout of American combat troops from Iraq's cities is one day away. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has staked his reputation on this and declared tomorrow a national holiday. But as the deadline nears, deadly bombings in Iraq have increased ominously. President Obama has made it clear there is no turning back. This is not his war. This hour on Point, the pullout of American troops from Iraqi cities and where that leaves the Iraqis. You can join the conversation. Is President Obama moving too quickly? Are Americans, are you prepared to watch from the sidelines if Iraq falls back into chaos? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Anthony Shadid, Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. He's been in and out of Iraq since 1998 and won a Pulitzer Prize in 2004 for his coverage of the Iraq War. He is author of the book Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. Welcome, Anthony. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
And also with us from Baghdad is Sahar Issa, correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers based in Baghdad. She is Iraqi. Sahar, nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Anthony, I'll begin with you. Set the table for this conversation this hour. From a broad perspective, what does the pullout of American combat troops mean for Iraq?
Well, you know, I think this is a part of a year that everyone has seen as seminal, a year in, you know, give and take a few months on each end. You know, we started with the Status of Forces Agreement, which reoriented the U.S.-Iraqi relationship. Provincial elections, the first since 2005, followed. And now we're at this moment that is going to, in some ways, make most concrete the beginning of a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. It's going to be followed by the parliamentary elections in January, which, again, is going to be another decisive moment, one in which Iraqis choose another government, and one also that probably inaugurates a much more rapid withdrawal of U.S. troops. So I think a lot of people will be looking right now at how this initial withdrawal goes and what kind of country, what kind of security situation the Americans are going to be leaving behind.
Sahar, what do you see exactly on the ground? What will change in Iraq?
To tell you the truth, Jane, what will change is the fears of Iraqi people, the unknown that they see and they face. What will change also is either a build-up in the confidence they have for the Iraqi security forces, if they were able to do the job, or a collapse. All this remains to be seen. Tomorrow will be the first day, and the days to come will prove them either right or wrong.
Christian Science Monitor today, Anthony, reports that American combat troops will be pulling out of Iraq's cities, most volatile cities, but they then will shift to the encircling areas to try to stop this, you know, al-Qaeda in Iraq and other insurgents groups. So the strategy seems to be to pull out of the cities, encircle them instead. Is that right?
You know, I think that's the idea out there. And, you know, they do have to leave the cities. There's going to be some issues that become problematic, I think, as the days and weeks go forward. Have they actually withdrawn from the cities? Of course, there will be, you know, a role that American troops will play as trainers or as advisors. They still will be in the cities. And I think the Iraqi government's going to have to wrestle with this. You know, do Iraqis see them, the Americans, as having not withdrawn when these advisors or trainers are still seen in the cities? But you're right. I mean, there is going to be people are leaving. Bases are being closed down. The Iraqi government, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, is pushing for these bases to be closed down maybe perhaps more rapidly than the Americans would choose. So it is going to be a much different American footing, you know, come next week or come this week.
Sahar, Anthony made reference to U.S. troops now being called advisors or trainers.
Yes.
But with no Iraqi Air Force, no Navy, no medical units, I mean, are there contingency plans for the U.S. to swoop in and assist if necessary?
We hear, of course, from the authorities that the U.S. Will be, the U.S. Troops will be in bases not far away, and that they will be ready to swoop in, as you put it, to assist if there was an emergency that the Iraqi security forces couldn't handle. And it is true that a lot of the people, a lot of the Iraqis are going to think not a lot has changed. You must, however, keep in mind that there are some provinces in Iraq that have not seen American troops in cities or towns for almost 2 years now. So the Iraqi point of view differs actually on the location from which the person you are talking to comes from, if he comes from Karbala or Najaf. Of course, regaining the sovereignty is much more important because day-to-day issues are not hindered by the withdrawal of the American forces. Mm. Whereas if you speak to people who are in other provinces like Mosul or Diyala, where the situation is still troubled, people do think about what is going to happen if the terrorists were to return, if the security situation were to collapse. Where would the Americans be then? Mm. How would they stand on this? Will they be able to assist?
So some areas are ready for the pullout and some are not, Anthony.
That's a great point that Sahar just made. She's exactly right. And I mean, I think what most people are going to be focusing on is the situation in Baghdad, for instance, and in Baquba and Diyala province, which is northeast of Baghdad, and then, of course, in Mosul, which remains the most troubled city in Iraq at this point. That probably is going to be the test of whether this withdrawal, or however we define it from here on, you know, succeeds or doesn't.
Here's Commander General for the Multinational Forces, Ray Odierno, yesterday on Fox News Sunday. He's talking about the readiness of Iraqi security forces to handle security.
We've seen constant improvement in the Iraqi security forces over the last 2 years. We've also seen improvement in local governance, in provincial governance. We've seen some improvement in the federal government. We've also seen the resilience of the citizens and the fact that they want the Iraqi security forces to take over security.
Anthony Sadid, what do you think? What about the Iraqi forces themselves? Are they ready?
You know, it's hard not to be, I mean, as a reporter, I think as any reporter who's been there for the past few years, it's hard not to listen to comments like this and be a little bit skeptical. We have been hearing the same thing since 2003, and it hasn't always proven to be true, to say the very least. Right. I think there is a lot of talk out there on the American side of people being ready to take over, of the government improving, of, like he's pointed out, provincial councils doing a better job. You know, like, it's more of a mixed bag, I think, to be somewhat blunt about it. I don't think all the security forces are anywhere near being ready to take over. This insurgency gave the Americans, you know, a tough fight until they managed to co-opt, you know, a good deal of its popular support in Western Iraq. It still maintains a presence in the country, and it's a very, these guys are, they're intelligent and they're tenacious, and they know what it takes to create perceptions. And we can talk a little bit more about that, but the idea is always about creating a spectacle, and I think we are going to see that spectacle as we go forward.
Sahar, what do you think about the Iraqi forces? Do you agree with Anthony? To your mind, are they ready?
More or less, I do agree with Anthony, actually. The problem is, of course, that in a situation that was so mixed up, as Anthony mentioned, the government was very, very intensely focused on creating a body that is called the security forces. This body, of course, had duties. But creating this body so quickly and putting it together did not take the time for the proper training. It did not take the time for them to have the professional experience. It did not have the time for them to get the proper weapons. So although the Iraqi people, I am sure a lot of them will tell you that they would be very happy to see the Iraqi security forces keeping the peace all over Iraq, but at the same time, they have their doubts. It is true that the training is not as we would have liked it. The weapons are not as were promised, even the numbers. And this also differs according to the provinces, according to the cities. It differs from one place to the other. Generally speaking, people are skeptical, but they want to believe, Jane. They want to believe.
What do you think, Anthony? Add to that. I mean, you left Baghdad a week ago. You're going back on Tuesday. I mean, what's the feeling among Iraqis toward U.S. troops, toward this withdrawal, generally speaking?
You know, I think you always have this kind of these mixed emotions, and it's always hard to say that there's one, you know, constant narrative when you talk about, you know, sentiments toward the Americans, toward the occupation, toward, you know, toward the future. You know, obviously, Iraq is a proud country, and it's a proud people. No one, you know, wants an occupying army there. So I think there is I think most people would want the Americans to leave sooner rather than later. At the same time, there is fear of what's going to follow. And I think this is something we've often seen, this sense of, you know, this disenchantment or this frustration with the occupation, but at the same time wondering what kind of vacuum the Americans are going to create when they do depart cities like they're going to do this week.
Here's President Obama talking this week about the recent violence in Iraq. This is during a press conference on Friday.
I will tell you, if you look at the overall trend, despite some of these high-profile bombings, Iraq's security situation has continued to dramatically improve. And when I speak to General Odierno, and Chris Hill, our ambassador in Iraq, they continue to be overall very positive about the trend lines in Iraq.
Sahar, President Obama saying violence is dramatically improving. I mean, has there not been an escalation in attacks, especially in recent days?
Well, to tell you the truth, yes, there has been an escalation in attacks. And we have been warned of this several times by authorities here in Iraq. And, of course, it is always given out that there are people with agendas. There are terrorists, there are Baathis, there are Al-Qaeda, there are all sorts of people who want to be the last violence. Because of them, the Americans will leave. This is one thing. And another people have another point of view, and they say that this is not the case. This is it is a way to imprint Iraqi mentality that there can be no security without the presence of the American forces. There are so many people thinking so many things here, Jane, and as Anthony put it, you can't take the point of view of one person and generalize it, because in different locations people have different points of view because they are affected differently by this event.
Anthony, speak to that. There seem to be conflicting opinions about the level of violence. I mean, what is it?
I think Sahar's right. I mean, what the insurgency has been very adept at doing since 2003 has been creating spectacles, this perception of American failure, this perception of collapsing security. It's in a large part about perceptions, and I think we are going to see spectacular acts of violence as part of this perception. Whether it's something more enduring, I think, is the question we'd have to ask, you know, in retrospect later on.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the pullout of American combat troops from Iraqi cities on the eve of the June 30th deadline, Tuesday. We're speaking this hour with Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. He's been in and out of Iraq since 1998. He is author of Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. And with Sahar Issa, correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers based in Baghdad. She is Iraqi. Sahar, let me turn this question to you. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki declared a national holiday on Tuesday, tomorrow, to celebrate the pullout of American troops. What's at stake for Maliki right now?
Maliki, if you look at the government and the state of Iraq since he came to office, he is riding on the card of security. If we look back from the day he took position until today, you will find that the only really successful thing he has done, he, or that has happened, he and other people, is that the country is relatively more secure now than it used to be then. This is the card that he is gambling on. And, of course, for him, the security is the card that he is going to ride into the next elections on. And this is also a big... Yes, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm reading in the New York Times where he's called the withdrawal of American troops from Iraqi cities, quote, a great victory, a repulsion of foreign occupiers. Anthony Shadid, I mean, how is he viewed inside of Iraq with these kinds of statements?
Well, just like Sahar said, I mean, he's, you know, he can't, it would be hard for an Iraqi leader to say otherwise. I mean, he has to fashion himself as a nationalist, as a patriot, and to sanction, you know, an occupation of your own country would definitely diminish your credentials in that regard. And I think it's, what you're getting at, I think also is an interesting, I mean, it just like Sahar said, it's Maliki, it's all about security for him at this point. And the success or failure of this American withdrawal from cities bears directly on Maliki's political fortunes, and in particular his fortunes in the elections in January. I mean, what President Obama said in terms of violence decreasing is right. It is a much safer country. As journalists, we can travel through Iraq in a way we could not have done in 2 years ago. That war for survival, that almost genocidal war that was fought in 2006 and 2007 is over. But I think there's a struggle that's no less perilous that's underway at this point, and that's the success or failure of Maliki in some ways, this struggle for power in the country. And politics at this point do revolve around the prime minister. His success or failure will bear, you know, very directly on the ability of Iraq to constitute a political system that's somehow endurable.
Sahar, what does it mean that Prime Minister Maliki controls a Shiite army And some of the most volatile provinces still are Sunni. I mean, moving forward with the army now in full control and U.S. troops mostly out, what kind of situation does that set up?
Well, to tell you the truth, this is a situation that we started with. The situation that he did indeed have Iraqi security forces that were, a majority of them were Shiite, and therefore the Sunni neighborhoods were left to fester. They were left to fester to a degree that they were uncontrollable and the Shiite forces couldn't even go in. That is what I think promoted the awakening force. The awakening force was a force that was a decision was a unilateral by the American forces to bring it forth and able to control the Sunni neighborhoods that were out of the reach of the Shiite Iraqi security forces. That, of course, is something that we have to contend with in the coming future. What is going to happen there? After all, it is until now, until lately, the American security forces have been backing the Sahwa. And the Sahwa, or the Awakening, are the people who are keeping the peace in these neighborhoods or in these provinces, let us say. So what is going to happen now? It is contemplation, of course. We hope that the 20% of the Sahwa that are allegedly incorporated into the Iraqi security forces will be deployed in these areas to keep the peace. But there is no plan. We have asked and asked and asked, and the authorities say we have a plan, but no one is willing to give out any details because it is, for security reasons. So the plan is still unknown, but, of course, everyone is skeptical.
To your mind, Anthony, what will it mean, this new plan, whatever it may be, but essentially Shiite armies patrolling Sunni areas?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting to me just in coming back, over this year is to see how, there's no question that there remains a sectarian conflict in Iraq. That's absolutely clear. And as Sahar pointed out, with Sahwa, they had promised to bring 20% of these awakening Sunni fighters into the security forces. They perhaps done 2%, if that. And I don't think there's any intention on the part of Maliki's government to bring the rest in. They're going to abandon these people. But I think what you're seeing increasingly, as I mentioned earlier, politics do revolve around the prime minister to a degree that I hadn't seen earlier in Iraq. Maliki has consolidated power. He has a group of people around him that are known as the impenetrable circle. Mm-hmm. If what Maliki is trying to do is trying to co-opt some groups that are willing to play ball with him, he's willing to crack down on others who are going to resist him. So when it comes to the Awakening movement, for instance, if there are some leaders in Diyala province, for instance, or up in Nineveh or in other areas of the country, in Anbar in particular, that will create some kind of informal alliance with him, he will give them patronage. He will shower money on them. If they're not willing to do that, he's going to crack down. I think we're going to increasingly see fractured politics in that way. Maliki trying to strike deals with different people in different parts of the country that, while there is still a sectarian tint to it, we're starting to see politics that are more about patronage, influence, favors.
So that's fractured politics. What about the army itself? Do you see the Iraqi army remaining cohesive? Will that splinter as well?
That's tough to say. You already have competing loyalties. You have Maliki, two units that will answer directly to Maliki in Baghdad. He's used those as basically his, he has men with guns now, which he didn't have earlier. Other units are loyal to other figures. Is it a cohesive unit at this point? It's not. Could it be down the road? I guess it could be, but that's something that we're going to see, I think, play out over a year or so.
Let's go to the phones now, invite some of our listeners into the conversation. First to Ames, Iowa. Helen is on the line. Thank you for waiting, Helen. Welcome to On Point.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, my comment is, we're not going to be leaving Iraq. All this talk about the United States leaving Iraq, I get really upset with that. We have more private contractors there than we do Army. There are more private contractors now in Afghanistan than we do our own military. We have a green zone the size of 8 football fields. That's not going to go away. So my point is, we are not leaving Iraq. We'll be there for years and years and years.
Helen, thank you. I mean, give us the actual numbers, Anthony. What are they?
Well, you still do have 130,000 U.S. troops in there, and I think you'll have, levels, close to that until after the January, parliamentary elections, when I guess American officials expect to have a much more dramatic drawdown. The caller is right. There is still a vast U.S. presence in that country. There will be a vast U.S. presence even after this August deadline that the president has set for, next August deadline that the president has set for a withdrawal of combat troops. you know, my own gut feeling on this is that these bases are there to stay. But then you have, you know, this administration on the record saying that the bases will be dismantled as part of the agreement that was, you know, struck in December. You know, what kind of long-term U.S. presence you have, it's tough to say. You know, one thing I would, you know, just add is that it is hard for me to imagine this administration reengaging in Iraq, whatever degree of violence we see over the next 6 months, 9 months, or a year. This administration has made clear that this is not its war. In short of an invasion by, say, Iran, it's tough for me to see these levels of troops increasing. You know, whether there's a smaller presence that's somewhat permanent, I think that's very likely. But in terms of seeing a dramatic increase, that's just, I don't think that's in the cards at this point.
Sahar, do you agree?
Yes, actually, I do. Indeed, I do. From the point of view of Iraqis, of course, it is almost the same. They believe that Americans will be becoming more difficult to see, but they will be there behind the scenes. They will be where decision-making is concerned. They will be there where support, aid, advice to the government is needed. And that is why, actually, they still look on the government as somewhat a fragile structure that is only propped up by the American presence and the strength given to them by the American presence. Yes.
You use the word fragile structure in terms of the government. I'm curious then about these January elections. How significant is that election January 30th, Anthony?
Well, I think it's critical. I mean, I think of these events that I mentioned earlier on, these kind of seminal moments we're seeing over this year, beginning with the agreement in December, provincial elections in January, the deadline that we're dealing with this week. I think the parliamentary elections will be by far the most important of those, and that's mainly because it's going to set up a government that's going to last for years ahead, and it is going to be the government that inherits Iraq after, you know, the United States ostensibly withdraws combat troops in August of next year.
Let's go back to the phones. Augusta, Georgia, is where we find Robert. Robert, welcome to On Point.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly, go ahead.
Okay, we'd be supportive to our new commander-in-chief and with a program with less conflict so that there's a peering down of what appears to have been happening with our new commander-in-chief and president. Certainly there are new initiatives not only in Iraq but in the Islamic world with drawdown on troops like his platform indicated would help out with less conflict and better initiatives and more control by the Iraqis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I believe that's the main initiative, and I believe that's what is trying to be taking place, which sounds pretty good, you know, both me as a citizen and from Augusta and the person that was commander-in-chief of the National Guard promoted to three-star general. Certainly, we're very supportive of.
Are you optimistic about American combat troops pulling out? Are you optimistic about the future there, Robert?
Well, they become support troops. In other conflicts, it took 10 support troops to support one combat troop.
Mm-hmm.
These people would be able to bear down and think about what was going on and how the new initiatives of the Iraqi army is taking place and how well they're handling it.
Mm-hmm. Robert, thank you. Appreciate your call, your insights. Let's go to another call. Chris is in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Chris, welcome to On Point.
Hello, and welcome back, Anthony.
Thank you, Chris.
My question really relates to the surge.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my concern is that it's sort of maybe the last gift of the Bush administration, and not a good gift, that that the real what really has gone on with the surge is sort of paying off the Sunnis, and that when forces are withdrawn, we've just set the groundwork for an even more vicious civil war. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about that, all of you. Thanks a lot.
Chris, thank you. Anthony?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it was actually my expectation when I went back to Baghdad last December was that we were going to see a situation where the Americans have basically armed everyone and were trying to create a balance of terror. And there was a very high likelihood that people just fight it out. You know, what I've seen is a little bit different at this point. I mean, there's no question that there are elements of Sahwa, of the awakening, that feel abandoned by the Americans at this point. In fact, I was doing a story recently on a Sahwa leader in a town called Dhul-Uriya, which is northeast of Baghdad. He was arrested by Maliki's people. The Americans basically said we had nothing to do with him. A year ago, he has pictures of him, of himself standing with American troops, fighting in his town. I think it's become a little bit more complicated in some ways, though. I think Chris is right when he says that what we've basically done is arm a lot more people than we had armed before. There is an incredible potential for violence. The Americans are not as engaged as they were before, and they're trying to defer to Maliki on a lot of these decisions, and Maliki is is playing favorites to a certain degree. But I think it also goes to this point that I was mentioning earlier, is that Maliki is trying to find friends among these people, and friends is too nice of a word. He's trying to find people that he can buy off, basically, that he can bring into his orbit through patronage, through money, through influence. The people that he can do that, and I'm talking about Sahwa here, he will. The people that he can't, he will arrest, he will crack down on, he will try to marginalize. And it's going to be a very nasty business as we go forward.
Sahar, to Chris's point, does the U.S. pullout set the stage for an even more intense civil war in Iraq?
The contemplation amongst the intelligentsia here, when we speak to people and we read about it, and the reactions are, of course, is that unfortunately nothing has been really done to eliminate the problem that actually gave the kickoff to Sahwa, which is that the security forces are majorly Shiite, and that they will have difficulty in controlling and even in patrolling the Sunni areas and neighborhoods. And yes, it is difficult. Maliki is, as Anthony mentioned, trying to either woo or either buy off the leaders as they come along, those who respond to him, and those who do not, of course, get marginalized and their influence diminishes if they don't get detained or worse. This is what is happening, generally speaking. And as far also as the Sunni areas are concerned, there is a feeling, however, that when Maliki started passing himself off as a nationalistic person, distancing himself somewhat from the sectarian, more sectarian, let us say, Supreme Council and other components of the alliance, the Iraqi alliance, and trying to ally himself to like Sunni parties and like the Sadrists, who are all have the component of nationalism in their call and in their program. This is something that people want to believe. But at the same time, they know that it is probably the elections coming on, and things happen before the elections like this. And so whether it is true or whether it is just propaganda and a build-up for the elections, this is something that people think about.
Anthony Shadid, is there somebody waiting in the wings behind Nouria Maliki to perhaps lead Iraq? Is there some sort of power grab? I mean, who's behind the curtain? Is there anybody?
Exactly. I mean, I think that's the key point here, is there's not. I mean, Maliki has succeeded, very well in making himself basically the only alternative at this point. And, and Sahar's exactly right. There is this, there is a move by Maliki to create a coalition that at least has the veneer of being nationalistic, whether it is or not, whether it's not just a sectarian grab for power on the part of Maliki and everyone would be subordinate to him is another question. I mean, that's a very possible reading of it. But there is a move out there, and Maliki is trying to bring in people, not the Kurds necessarily, but trying to bring in Sunni Arabs as part of this coalition under this banner of nationalism to vie for those elections in January. I think whoever can figure out that coalition, whoever can figure out a coalition where it is somewhat representative, is somewhat nationalistic, it has a degree of popular support, that is going to be the key going forward. But creating that coalition is an incredibly difficult task.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the pullout of American combat forces from Iraqi cities. We're talking with Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. He's been in and out of Iraq since 1998, going back this week. He's author of Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. Sahar Issa is also correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers based in Baghdad. She is Iraqi. In a press conference on June 24th, Pentagon Press Secretary Jeff Morrell said the U.S. will still be engaged in Iraq even after the pullout of combat troops.
So long as there exists still this this threat in Iraq, and so long as the government is still trying to develop to the point where it can assume all of these responsibilities that we have been assisting them in, we still think there is a role for us, and we would be hesitant to declare victory.
So, Anthony Shadid, even with U.S. forces there for some time to come, you were telling me during the break that the internal power struggle is really just beginning. I found that so interesting.
Yeah, I think that is the case. I mean, I think I don't want to by any means dismiss what's happened since 2003. I mean, the American invasion itself unleashed forces of almost awesome and how much they and the impact they had on the country. And I think they led in sometimes direct fashion to the carnage, this almost unbelievable carnage that the country witnessed in 2006 and 2007. At the same time, I think the country that Iraq is going to become a generation from now, that the struggle for that country has really just begun. And again, it does, I mean, I can't underestimate the role of Maliki at this point, the prime minister. He is at the center of this struggle. He may not be a year from now, but the struggle that is underway right now, the struggle to figure out the coalition that's going to run Iraq, that's going to rule Iraq and shape Iraq as the Americans leave in some fashion, really has just begun.
Let's go back to the phones. In Franklin, Tennessee, Rob is waiting. Thank you for calling. Rob, go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
In spring of 1966, I graduated from college. I went to the Peace Corps. I learned a foreign language, public health, tropical medicine, spent 2 years in the Amazon, came back, got drafted, went through basic training, artillery training, then spent a year in Vietnam. Why is it taking so long to train the security forces in Iraq, or is this going to turn out like Vietnam? We're going to pull out, and they're going to just settle the problem themselves.
Rob, thank you very much. Sahar, would you answer the caller's point?
Yes, actually, this is the question that is not only in Rob's mind, it is in all our minds. Why is it taking so long to produce a force that is professional and well-trained?
Yes.
I think the first answer is that there is a lot of corruption going around, bringing in people who are not up to the task. The training itself is not as it should be. A lot of the Iraqi forces, you will find that there is a recruiting center, people go to the recruiting center, they are given a uniform and a weapon, and they are told to appear at their post 2-3 days later. This has happened, and as I mentioned before, this is because, generally speaking, the government wanted to have the image of Iraqi forces. It did not take into consideration that these Iraqi forces needed to be built step from step, right from the beginning. This is one thing. The other thing is the caliber of man who is going and being recruited to the Iraqi forces. We must know that at the time being in Iraq, in Baghdad, in all the provinces, the only job to be had is a security person. And so people who have lost their farms have gone to be recruited. The people who have lost their jobs have gone to be recruited. People who have no turn of, the mentality of the security person, the ability, even the physical ability of the security person. These are the people who are being recruited into the Iraqi forces. Relatives of ministers, relatives of officers, relatives and relatives and relatives and friends and acquaintances. All these people are being brought into the force. They are not getting the proper training. But this is an excellent question. Why are they not getting the proper training? They have unlimited budget. They have people to train them. The American forces have undertaken the task. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we should at one point turn and ask the question to the American forces. Why, after 6 years of training and advising services, are still the Iraqi mm-hmm. forces, as they were 6 years ago, not capable of keeping the peace?
Anthony,
they are not a professional force.
Absolutely, I think that's such a great point. I think it is legitimate to ask the Americans why it has taken this long. I mean, you know, after the invasion in 2003, you know, a lot of the Iraqi security forces collapsed. The rest were dismantled by the United States. Since then, they've tried to reconstitute these forces. Part of me wonders what kind of military force the Americans wanted to create. I mean, they certainly didn't want something that was along the lines of what Saddam Hussein had pre 2003. A very powerful military in some respects, at least regionally. not when it came to fighting the Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the idea is maybe a force that can police Iraq, that can keep a relative sense of quiet there, can pose no threat whatsoever to its neighbors. I think that is the kind of military force that the Americans have envisioned. But there is a sense, I think, and as Sahar pointed out, there is a sense among Iraqis that they haven't gotten the equipment that the Americans have. They aren't treated the same way that the American soldiers are. One of my favorite anecdotes is driving through a town west of Baghdad near Fallujah, and there was a Humvee, and it was a Humvee that was not in very good shape. It was painted white, and written on it in graffiti was, "I swear to God, it's a Hummer." And I think there was just kind of a sense that, you know, we are treated as second class citizens here in our own country.
How will the unrest in Iran affect U.S. pullout in Iraq? Anthony, you first.
Well, I think it's too early to see anything from that, to be honest. I mean, what the Iranians have done so skillfully in Iraq is pretty much play everyone at the same time. I mean, there's, you know, different units of Iranian intelligence that will be engaged with different elements inside Iraq itself. There's plenty of money going through, especially in southern Iraq. I think the Iranians, in some respects, have more influence than the Americans do at this point. I don't see that influence necessarily decreasing, especially over a crisis that's still very unsettled in Iran. Now, if we were to see Ahmadinejad, for instance, you know, step down, if we were to see somehow the Iranian leadership reconstituted, I think you're going to see some repercussions in Iraq. But at this point, I think, you know, the Iranians are so deeply engaged in Iraq, their presence is so widely felt that it would be, you know, it'd be hard to see that diminish anytime soon.
Sahar, your thoughts?
Thank you, Anthony, for saying that so well. Yes, their influence actually is very deep and very profound. But at the same time, I was surprised to find that really not very many Iraqis, even Shiites who are tending towards the east in Iraq, take really very much interest in the Iranian elections. It is as if for them it doesn't matter whether it was Ahmadinejad or someone else who is leading Iran, as far as there was a more dominant force that is above him. And their influence in Iraq is indeed very wide. It is very profound. The U.S. forces and America will one day pick up and leave, but Iran is our neighbor. It's not going anywhere. And this is really quite scary to a lot of people inside Iraq.
Here's another call from Steve in Providence, Rhode Island. Steve, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jane. Mm-hmm. My point may be one of these things that could just lead to an academic discussion, but I'd hope it didn't, and that is that Iraq is about one-tenth the size of the United States. Last week, with the supposed spike in violence now back up to 250 people killed in 1 week, that would be close to the number of people lost on September 11th in the United States. And 6.5 years into the war, 6 years and change into the war, what's the prospect that anything is going to change? And the caller earlier who said the sort of Bush gift that keeps on giving, here's the Bush gift that keeps on giving. And the moral culpability of the United States, it seems to me, is horrible in this. In our country, that would be close to 3,000 people a week if that spike in violence stays anywhere near that level of 250. Mm-hmm. So what do your commentators have to say about any prospect that that's going to get better, and at what point, and at what loss to that country?
Steve, thank you. Anthony Shadid?
You know, I think it's a great point, and I think especially as journalists, you sometimes wonder, if you're, how do I put this, you wonder how you are portraying an improvement. And I mean, what does an improvement necessarily constitute? The violence is not like it was in 2006 and 2007. That's true. But just as you pointed out, the violence is still often spectacular. I mean, the number of people dying is still vast. And as you pointed out, if it was, you know, comparable to U.S. figures, you would see, you know, even more dramatic numbers. I think this violence is going to keep going on. I think the struggle that's underway for power is going to be exceedingly perilous. I think it's going to be fought, you know, perhaps not in the massacres that we saw in 2006 and 2007, but it is going to be fought through assassinations, through torture, through arrests. And Maliki is deeply involved in this. I mean, this is part of his, you know, his attempt to consolidate power. You know, what kind of country we're going to see in a year is probably going to be a lot like the country we see today. Whether we're going to see a different kind of country in 10 years and 15 years, that's harder to say.
What do you think, Sahar? What kind of country is left behind now that many U.S. troops are leaving?
Yes, actually, I do believe that it might very well be getting a little bit worse than after that, maybe a little bit better. The problem is, of course, is that a lot of sides, as we call them, a lot of parties and groups inside Iraq are simply waiting for the Americans to leave. Why? Because they consider the Americans to be a neutral force, if nothing else. And as soon as the Americans leave, they believe that they will be able then to make their point. And if they are the kind of persons to make their point with weapons, then they will. A lot of people think that, for instance, Muqtada al-Sadr is waiting to make a position. Why? Because as long as the American forces are present, there is an occupier. It is different. When the occupier leaves, then it will be different. This is one. The other, you will find a strange change that in 2003 it was the Shi'at coalition that were holding on to the American forces for dear life, but later it changed that they got stronger and the security forces gave them, empowered them. It became the Sunnis who first denounced the American presence in Iraq, were the people who were holding on to them for dear life. As these things change, of course, the real healing process will not really start until they've had it out, one way or the other, after the American forces leave.
It was very well put. I mean, you know, diminishing or a decrease in violence isn't necessarily success. It isn't necessarily victory. And I think we have to be very careful how we judge, you know, what we are, what the Americans have left behind.
How will journalism be affected after this U.S. withdrawal, Anthony?
You know, what's one thing that is so interesting to me is when we were there in 2003, when pretty much no one knew what was going on, and I'll be the first to say that it was so inscrutable in some ways to try to figure out what direction these forces that were intersecting were headed. Now we're in a period, there were hundreds of journalists back there. Now we're in a period where, you know, we can travel again as compared to 2006, 2007. We can go anywhere in the country. There is a sense of, you can kind of try to get a handle on where the story is headed, where the in what direction the country is headed. We can report it. We can cover it. And, you know, it's sad to say that there are far fewer journalists that are reporting it now. And I think we're going to see even fewer journalists come January of 2010, when in some ways the most important events so far in the country are about to get underway.
Let's get another call in here. Neil is in East Hampton, New York. Neil, welcome to the program. Thank you for waiting, sir.
Yes, thank you. You know, we went into Iraq and we never had a plan. And from that comes a whole range of expectations that are absolutely unrealistic. And it works on several different levels. You went into a country where you had a minority that oppressed the majority, often really violently. And you had sectarian issues that have existed forever. And now you try to measure, you know, how the progress is made by sort of absurd ideas. You know, until the troops are out of there and the Iraqis deal with each other, there's never any real sense of what's going to happen and where this thing is going.
Neil, thank you.
It doesn't matter what we expect or what we believe. You know, we're in the process. We mucked it up, and now we got to get out and let them deal with it.
Mm. Neil, thanks. Unrealistic measurement of success, unrealistic expectations, at least for the Americans, Anthony, is Neil's point.
You know, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think as long as the Americans are in Iraq, there will be, you know, I think if not the majority of Iraqis, a substantial minority will always consider the Americans the real kingmakers in that country. And I think even when we see troops, I mean, this number of advisors, if it's 30,000, if it's 50,000, you know, whatever it represents, it's still a very large number of troops. As long as they're there, Americans will still be seen as the kingmakers. I mean, one of the fundamental kind of narratives you've seen since 2003 in Iraq is, you know, is the state legitimate or not? Is the state legitimate in the eyes of most Iraqis? And I think that's still a question to ask in 2009. And I think a lot of the problems can be traced back to that. Do the security forces have loyalty to a state that is considered legitimate by most people in the country? And, you know, I think the verdict is still out on that. That question will not be resolved until the Americans are gone. And I think the caller is exactly right. The sooner that happens, in some respects, the better. It may get more violent. It may get more dangerous. But also these fundamental questions of what kind of country is going to be created, what kind of country is going to evolve, you know, cannot happen as long as the Americans are there.
What is the worst case scenario for Iraq now, Sahar?
The worst case scenario, I believe, for Iraq is that, as I said, some forces may be just waiting on the American forces to leave the cities so that they feel they have a free hand. This is probably the worst case scenario if they want to fight it out, although, of course, the probability is always there that sooner or later the American forces have to leave, and after that, Iraqis will just have to contend and reach some sort of stability after it. A worst-case scenario is that the violence comes on again, and there are worst issues still, because when there is violence, violence is like, Jane, it's like a blanket. You lose sight of everything. When human life is at stake, you lose sight of everything else. So there, the corruption goes up, and looting. Looting is not just stealing the very culture, stealing the very civilization. Whatever we have, we did not have really very, very much. But what we had, even what we had, we are trying to crawl back to square one, and we're not even imagining that. So the worst case scenario is the violence comes on again, and when it does, we lose sight of everything else, and everything becomes not important anymore.
Anthony Shadid, can you wrap us up here with a silver lining? Can you find a silver lining here?
Well, it's tough to say what a silver lining is. I mean, it's just
hope for Iraq.
It is so awesome, the devastation and the carnage that we've seen, you know, caused by the forces unleashed back in 2003. But I don't see a failed state in Iraq the way we've seen at times in Lebanon's history and Palestine. You know, I think if there's one silver lining, there is still a sense of nationalism, a sense of pride in Iraq. I think there's a vast amount of money that the central government can deploy and in very crass ways, sometimes use it to forge at least some kind of consensus or some kind of power in which the country can revolve.
Anthony Shadid, a Pulitzer Prize-winning Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post, Sahar Issa, correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers based in Baghdad. Thank you so much for your time and your perspectives.
Pleasure.
Be safe. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.